From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. In early May, the 1 million people of St. Louis County in Missouri woke up to news that their county executive, Steve Stenger, had pled guilty to federal corruption charges. Stenger admitted to taking part in five separate pay-to-play schemes whereby people who donated large sums to his campaign were rewarded with county contracts. Now, this wasn't totally surprising. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the local newspaper, had been reporting on county deals with Stenger's campaign contributors for months. In fact, much of the evidence in the federal charges against Stenger had first been reported by the newspaper. Now, what may be surprising about this episode to people 5 or 10 years from now was that there was even a local newspaper to report this story. Like other local papers, the Post-Dispatch has been hemorrhaging readers and advertising revenues for years. Its newsroom staff has shrunk by about two-thirds since 2006. Online subscriptions are just a fraction of the print advertising revenues that have been lost. And what's happening at the Post-Dispatch is happening not just all across the United States. Across the globe, the local news business is in crisis. And this situation led the Index on Censorship to devote an entire issue of its quarterly magazine to the subject. The cover of its spring edition is called, "Is This All the Local News? What Happens If Local Journalism No Longer Holds Power to Account?" So today we're going to do the first of a multi-part series on this subject with our partners at the Index on Censorship. In a few minutes, we'll hear about declining local news in Mexico and the expansion of news deserts here in the U.S. But first, we're joined by Rachel Jolly. She's the editor of the Index on Censorship magazine, and she joins us now from London. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, I think to some young people, some of this sort of teeth-gnashing about the disappearance of local news outlets will sound like nostalgia, and younger people are always hearing from older people about how things used to be better when they were younger, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Talk to us about that.
Well, you might think that, but actually, it's really interesting. I've had people come up to me and say, people in their 20s and say, I'd never thought about this before. It actually really does matter, and I think given what's been happening in terms of protests, young people coming out on different types of protests around the world and wanting to hold power to account, they're very aware of how and what they need to use and what are the methods they can use to make a difference, to shout out to government, whether it's local government, local councils, local businesses, and say, you know, we want change. And maybe they haven't thought of that as through their local news media. But that's why we want to do this issue and say, if local news disappears, who's going to hold power to account? Because I think it's about connecting those two things. It's not just, oh, your local paper is disappearing, what a shame. It's like, what is the gap left if your local news media disappear?
And you make the argument that this isn't just something that's happening in the US or the UK. It's something that's happening all over.
That's right. And I think what we really want to do with this issue is look at the global picture, because people often reflect on what's happening in their neighborhood or in their country. But we are a global magazine, and we always try and look at issues globally, and local news is no exception to that. So we looked at what was happening in local news in China, in India, in Argentina, in Turkey, in the US, in the UK, in Italy. And we found basically the same picture, but for different reasons and different concerns. So in Turkey, local newspapers and local news media are declining. Part of the reason is the political situation in Turkey, and that we're seeing large numbers of journalists in Turkey being locked up. In India, we're seeing a different story. We're seeing a lot of journalism and the growth of journalism in India, but we're seeing a lot of pressures on local journalists who are paid very little to take bribes and to become corrupt, so to write the stories that people would like them to write. In China, local newspapers have gone through a period of being relatively free, which people outside China might be surprised to hear. The government is now tightening up politically and its control of the media, and so that's restricting what local news media can write. And then Chinese newspapers are also struggling with economic pressures that local newspapers are struggling with all over the world, which is the rise of the internet and the departure of advertising from local news to the internet-based media such as Facebook.
Yeah, and well, what are some of the consequences then as local news disappears? Obviously, there's going to be one less institution that's sort of watching whether or not the local politician is giving government contracts to his friends, but is there a broader issue?
Well, it's very much, if we open the space and say, okay, local council, you can do what you want and no one's going to be watching, or local magistrates courts or crown courts, say in the UK, what's going to happen when things go wrong? What's going to happen when a big case happens and maybe the magistrates are working, the magistrates are people in court in the UK, we have a, similar to the US, we have a jury system, and but for lower level cases, we have people called magistrates who sit and make judgments. So if, and they tend to be civilians, you receive some training and they're making judgments. But if the media, if the local media is not there to report on something and the case goes very wrong, how are we going to find out about that? How are we going to be able to call that to account? And we've actually had the former Lord Chief Justice in the UK talking to us about his great worries that court cases are just not getting covered anymore. And very few court cases are now seeing a journalist sitting in court and covering the case, because it's an expensive business to have a reporter out of the newsroom for long periods of time.
Well, and you referenced also in one of your articles that some work a colleague of yours had done, I think it was in Liverpool in the UK, with some students, that sort of illustrates how this has actually changed sort of democratic norms.
That's right. We had a follow-up event once the magazine had come out with a roundtable in the Houses of Parliament. And one of the people who was there is a journalism professor at Liverpool, John Moores University. And she spoke about how she spent sending young journalists, people who are training in journalism, into local courts in Liverpool to cover court stories. And they're basically being told, oh, no, you can't come in here. You know, you've got no right to come into the court and report. And what Kate was talking about was, well, the thing is, they're not used to reporters turning up anymore. So therefore, if people forget that there is this right to report, and that's also what the former Lord Chief Justice said, then, you know, that right may disappear.
Well, I understand also that as part of this, you conducted some polls about sort of public attitudes towards this disappearance of local news. What did you find?
That's right. So we did two types of survey. We did a poll with YouGov, and we did a survey of people, senior editors working in local news in the UK. And the poll of senior editors and editors of local news and newspapers was really stark. 97% were really worried that local news was no longer holding power to account in the way that it had done in the past. That a lot less news was being covered. I mean, you know, these are people inside local news, so they really know their stuff. They know what's going on. And we talked to, with the YouGov poll, we talked to the public, and YouGov talked to 1,800 people for the YouGov poll. And the people who were most worried about local news disappearing, perhaps not surprisingly, was the over 65s. And that's possibly because that's a segment of society who have less access to the internet. One of our MPs in the UK, an MP for an Essex constituency, Robert Halfen, when his local newspaper closed down, he said that he's had this line of older people coming to his office saying, "How are we going to find out what's going on? There's no local news anymore, and we don't have access to the internet." So I think we can't assume everyone has digital access. I mean, that's just wrong. There's lots of people who don't have access to the internet, who can't afford access to the internet, who don't know how the internet works. And we can't say, oh, everything's going to go on the internet and that'll be all right.
Well, our time grows short, but I wanted to ask you as well. I mean, there was also, in one of your articles, you made the link between the disappearance of local news outlets in the UK and the referendums for the UK to leave the European Union. Like, how could those two be related?
Well, I think there's room for more research here, but one of the people we interviewed, who is a a former presenter on one of our big national radio news programmes, Libby Purvis, who was a presenter for the BBC Today programme. She started off as a local news reporter, doing features for Radio Oxford. And she, where there's a, there was at the time a big car plant, there were lots of strikes around that time that she was there. And she remembers how many stories they were doing about manufacturing and the pressures on the manufacturing industry at that point. And what she was saying, what she feels quite strongly, is that a lot of these, like similar to Middle America, I guess, these big industrial cities in the UK feel that perhaps their news is not getting covered as much. And that there's this feeling of people aren't listening to us anymore. And that has helped, she feels, contribute to a sort of sense of anger that may be contributing to the voices that are saying, well, we want to leave the EU. We're dissatisfied with what's happening in our lives, and we're dissatisfied with the way the economy is going, and we want change. And she felt that this was a contributing factor.
Well, Rachel Jolly, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
Sure.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, we're talking about the decline of local news all around the world. And when many people think of a journalist, they think of a famous national broadcaster like Christiane Amanpour or Anderson Cooper. But in many ways, it's people that report news in our own communities. They have a much bigger effect on our lives. We just heard about the challenges for local news outlets in the UK and around the world from Rachel Jolly. Up next, we're going to turn our attention closer to home to the US and take a look at the growth of what are being called news deserts in this country. For that, we're joined by Jan Fox. She's a contributing editor at the Index on Censorship. She wrote about this in their most recent issue in an article called News Loses. And she joins us now from Los Angeles. Jan, welcome.
Hello, thank you.
Well, Jan, tell us, what are these news deserts? Why are they expanding?
Well, news deserts really are nothing new. It's been happening for some time, but they are expanding at quite a rate. So news deserts is where your local news just goes away. It's either because newspapers are closed down, maybe they're bought up by big hedge funds that belong to bigger corporations, bigger newspaper groups, or they just die through lack of interest. And so a recent study from the University of North Carolina showed that of the 3,143 counties in the US, more than 2,000 have no daily newspaper. And if we look at the figures overall between...
That's a remarkable figure. So basically two-thirds of the counties in the US have no access to a daily newspaper then covering their own turf.
And also, between 2008 and 2017, newspaper staff has actually declined by quite an alarming 45%. So, you know, far less journalists, far less newspapers out there. And this is a trend that's been going on for some time, but it's just getting worse and worse.
But Jen, aren't there other types of new media that are filling this void? What about local television news? Aren't there alternatives to just simply printing the news on pieces of paper and throwing it on someone's lawn?
Yeah, local TV seems to be filling some of the gap, but it tends to be very much of the soundbite variety. If you listen to your local news here in LA, for example, one of the local news stations, the average sort of span of a story is maybe 30 seconds and then you're on to the next thing. There's very little in-depth investigation into local news. So TV to some extent filling the gap, but I think, you know, people are also turning perhaps to social media for news. Again, though, that is something that's, you know, not very satisfying in terms of the depth it can go into.
And I know that it's difficult to measure the cost of something that doesn't exist or something that has disappeared, but you argue that there's actually a financial cost to the public of not having local news reporting, of not having local newspapers.
Yes, because if we are, as Rachel made the point, if we're not holding local politicians to account, we don't know what they're doing with our money. So they may be doing a good job, they may not. We just simply don't know because, you know, we're not kind of, it's not being covered in any way. We're not going to, newspaper reporters aren't going to local meetings, to town council meetings, to health board meetings, to zoning meetings. You know, where is our money being spent? Is it being spent well or not? We just don't know.
Yeah, and I think you use a telling example as well in your article about this small suburb in Los Angeles where the town manager and some other officials had been stealing millions of dollars over a period of time. And I know that one of the ways that Metro daily papers have been pulling back, as has happened in St. Louis, as has happened in Los Angeles, I believe, is by closing suburban bureaus and firing local news reporters who used to cover sort of suburban town council meetings. Talk to us about what happened in this town of Bell, California.
Yeah, it's a small suburb of Los Angeles. And for years, the town manager and other people that he worked with, other employees, had been pocketing public funds to the tune of $5 million. His name is Robert Rizzo. And basically, because there was no local paper sort of going to these meetings, covering what was going on, it got sort of ignored for years. And the LA Times has been very stretched. I mean, we tend to think of it perhaps as a more of a national newspaper, but so it's kind of covering a lot more national news. And they had staffing problems, so they weren't able to sort of, you know, cover every single suburb, every single meeting themselves. But finally, they got a very small team of investigative reporters together, and they broke this story. Rizzo ended up going to jail. Robert Rizzo, the town manager, ended up going to jail. But it was years that they were able to get away with stealing $5 million of public money.
Well, why is it? I know that a lot of newspapers have tried different models. It seems like for some, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, they've been fairly successful at getting readers to pay subscription fees to read the news online. It doesn't seem like that's been as successful for local news outlets. Why do you think that is?
I really don't know. I mean, I think I don't know if people realize the implications of not having local news. Perhaps it's because we've had some bad models of local newspapers that are just like throwaway papers full of adverts and maybe telling us about the local Chamber of Commerce giving some award or something. And so people have lost interest. And to Rachel's point, I think that sometimes we only realize, you know, we only wake up when something goes wrong in our community. And then we want to know all about it and why wasn't this covered, instead of being proactive and saying, you know, let's hold our local politicians to account. Let's find out what's going on in our communities. And I think, you know, the other sort of major points why this is important is not just holding local government accountable for spending, but also about being an informed voter. I think it's very important. You know, there's a study done by Notre Dame Business School that showed, you know, if we don't have any local newspapers, then we have, you know, less informed voters. And in fact, we have lower voter turnout. So that's very important for our democracy.
Well, let me just stop you there, because obviously with the spread of the internet, there's been this spread of social media. And in many ways, citizens, people themselves are reporting on events in their community in ways that a local newspaper never could have done. Like, why isn't this a sufficient replacement?
I think it's because we don't trust social media in the same way. You know, with all this sort of stories about fake news, do people really trust what they're reading online on Facebook or whatever? You know, I think people do trust good local investigative journalism. There's been, you know, several incidents of proving that.
Well, no, I mean, I think that's a fair point, but our time grows short. So I wanted to ask you as well, I mean, everything is not doom and gloom in local news. You highlighted a particularly promising model for local news in the U.S. This is something called Tap Into. Tell us about what Tap Into is doing to try to improve local news.
Tap Into was founded by a guy called Mike Shapiro, and it's a franchise operation. It runs in five states on the East Coast. And what they're trying to do is every issue must carry at least one very local news story for their town. It also must cover, you know, like county news, and they must go to, they must attend local meetings. So they must cover, you know, town council meetings or zoning meetings and those kind of things.
So someone gets a franchise and presumably successful revenue model, but in return they have to do some of the local news reporting, exactly. Then it sounds like.
And they've got 8 million readers now. He started it 10 years ago, and they've got 8 million readers now, and it's really doing quite well. So that's a success story, which is encouraging, you know, that this experiment that he's done.
Well, Jen, we're just out of time. I mean, I know all of us in the news business are hoping that there'll be other successful startups like that in the future. Many have been tried. But Jen Fox, thank you so much for taking the time to join us.
You're welcome.
A reminder that you're tuned into Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On today's program, the first part of our series on the decline of local news around the world. We just heard about the growth of news deserts in the U.S. Now we're going to turn our attention to northern Mexico. There, the problem for local news reporters is that when they write the news, they're sometimes writing their own death warrants. That's because Mexico's drug cartels have effectively intimidated much of the local press into silence about gang-related corruption and violence. For more on this, we're joined by Stephen Woodman. He's a contributing editor at the Index on Censorship, and he joins us now from Guadalajara. Stephen, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I want to ask you about this northern state of Tamaulipas in Mexico, and it sounds like their reporters, they can't really report on the biggest news stories that are happening around them.
No, Tamaulipas is considered the country's oldest silent zone. So that means that in this state, there's really no meaningful investigative journalism. So citizens, locals have to turn to Twitter because they can't find out about the latest shootouts or blockades just by reading the local newspapers or what listening to the radio. So it's the press has really fallen into silence in this state.
Okay, so the newspapers, the news organizations there, it sounds like they've actually been terrorized into silence. What are some examples of that?
Well, there's basically it started around, it's been going on since basically the turn of the millennium. So around since the year 2000. But in 2006, there was an incident where there was a shootout in a newsroom and they detonated a grenade and paralyzed a journalist. And that was the kind of beginning of a new phase, a new dimension of terrorizing the press using terror tactics.
And these are drug cartels. I think it's the Zetas and there was another cartel that are battling for control in this area then.
These are drug cartels, but there is also sometimes a blurry line in unstable parts of Mexico, perhaps you could say across the country, between politicians and cartel bosses, cartel operatives. So it's sometimes difficult to say who's responsible, and public officials are also heavily involved in terrorizing the press.
And you had referenced the fact that there was a newspaper in the state capital of Tamaulipas. I think the capital is Ciudad Victoria. They were actually delivered sort of a gruesome package.
Yeah, in December last year, a box containing the severed heads and hands of an unidentified man was left outside the newspaper offices in a ice box in the state capital.
And this was this, I mean, what was the message to the newspaper?
The message is just do what we say, basically. It wasn't one of their colleagues, but it was very clear that the message was we're in charge and you need to report what we want you to report.
So you talk about this area of Mexico as being sort of a zone of silence where local news has basically been intimidated in silence. Not that there are no news organizations, but they can't report on sort of the most critical events that are happening in the area. And one aspect of this that I thought was fascinating was it sounds like the cartels themselves actually have spies in newsrooms. Talk to us about this.
Yeah, this is in Tamaulipas and in some other parts of Mexico, they have this system where they have people in the newsroom called enlaces or links, and they are the link up to the cartel. So they will check with the cartel and they will decide what can be and what cannot be published. And they are actually journalists that are compromised.
So within the newsrooms itself, and I understand, so obviously they're there to censor the news, but it sounds like they're also there to use the news organization sort of as an information weapon against their rivals or against a rival cartel.
Exactly. They basically perform the function of PR personnel. Sometimes they're responsible for putting reports out, cartel propaganda. And often they are the people that say, no, we're not allowed to publish this. This will get us into trouble.
And sometimes, correct me if I'm wrong, but they also ask news organizations to go cover acts committed by a rival cartel so that they get a lot of publicity and attention from the government.
Yes, that is a common practice in Tamaulipas as well. That's called heating up a rival's turf. So they will have a shootout or another violent incident on rival territory, and that's designed to send the security forces into the area and prevent, interrupt their rival's business, basically.
So given that this area, Tamaulipas, has become this zone of silence, or is Mexico's oldest zone of silence, it makes sense that a lot of people are turning to social media to get their news. I understand that there's this one sort of citizen reporter named Indomitable Wolf, who has been covering killings and corruptions in this area in a way that the news organizations can't. Talk to us about her.
Well, Indomitable Wolf, or Loba in Spanish, is one of the many citizen reporters who provide drug war news. So she uploads graphic photos of crime scenes or videos of gunfights provided by concerned citizens. And then she tweets the updates that she believes to be authentic and has to sift out any rumors or cartel propaganda. And she's motivated by a desire, really, to keep locals safe, to provide information about what's going on.
And so, just to emphasize, and this is a state that's right on the border of the U.S. It's just south of Brownsville, Texas, I believe. But the local news in these areas, it wouldn't be covering these killings if this wasn't being published on the internet, basically. Or the internet, Twitter is the only way that people are seeing and hearing about this.
Yes, this is it's the only way they can find out any details about what's going on in terms of who's behind these violent acts. Sometimes they report there was a shootout, but it'll be very general, leaving out any identifying details and telling you which cartel is behind what. So you can't find that information out without checking Twitter or Facebook, really.
Well, Stephen, I'm sorry our time grows short, but I did have one last question for you. There, Mexico does have a new president, Andrés López Obrador, took office in December. Has the situation for the press improved there since he took office?
Short answer is no. Basically, he has done some things that have been welcome. For example, he holds daily morning press conferences to talk to the press. But his language, he often uses negative rhetoric, directs that towards the press, describes them as being elitist, for example. And what the problem with that is that at state level, at local level, there are people that are going to take on this language, undermining journalists and reporters. And that could be really dangerous at local level.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Rachel Jolly, Stephen Woodman, Jan Fox, and the Index on Censorship. Our assistant producers this week are Seth Bodine, Lara Cumming, and Michelle Stoddard. Edom Kasai is our supervising producer. Megan Smaltz is visual editor. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.